with these civil rights obituaries, they just seem to completely ignore our more nuanced way of looking at civil rights. Like, we all know now how strategic a lot of the decisions that were made by civil rights leaders. They chose particular southern towns knowing that there would be violence, likely violence, and it would be captured by the media. But you don't see any of that kind of strategy involved in these obituaries.
Hello again, I'm Don Van Atta. Welcome back to The Art of Remembering, a series from the Sunday Long Read podcast. Today on the podcast, the ever-complex civil rights movement through the lens of obituaries with journalist and professor Kathleen McElroy. Thanks for being with us. This is the second of our first four episode series on obituaries. If you haven't yet, please check out my conversation with longtime New York Times obituary writer Margalit Fox in our first episode. This first new season of the SLR podcast is sponsored by our friends at Airmail, your essential weekend read from Graydon Carter, former editor of Vanity Fair, and Alessandra Stanley of the New York Times. My guest today is Kathleen McElroy. She has worked as a journalist for 30 years, 20 of them with the New York Times, where she was associate managing editor, deputy sports editor, dining editor, and deputy editor of the Times' website. And in 2013, McElroy wrote in a journal article that obits written as late as 2008 reduce the complex, multidimensional history of the civil rights movement. Kathleen is now a professor in the School of Journalism and Media at the University of Texas at Austin. Kathleen, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Don.
So when writing about obituaries in 2013, you quote Barack Obama, who was quoting William Faulkner in a campaign speech on race that Obama was giving. And this is the quote: "The past isn't dead and buried. In fact, it isn't even past." And so, Kathleen, in thinking about how journalism and race intersect, why did you gravitate towards obituaries as a subject of your research?
Well, while I was at the Times, I would have to look at obituaries, you know, as an editor. And I kept seeing the phrase, so-and-so was the grandson or granddaughter of slaves. It hit me, like, if you're a Black person from the South of a certain age, that's everybody. But it was sort of used as this like, you know, red badge of courage almost. And it just got me thinking, well, what are we saying in these obituaries? And I also just became fascinated by the fact that most obituaries of African Americans involve either civil rights or you're the first or a pioneer. So maybe an athlete, maybe an entertainer. So I just sort of just started looking at that sort of realm.
And you wrote a paper in 2013 for the Journal of Black Studies that was adapted from your 2009 master's thesis. Can you tell us how obituaries of civil rights leaders have perpetuated overly nostalgic and simplistic narratives of fundamentally complex people living through a historic time period?
Well, you know, I think the phrase journalism is the first draft of history, right? We hear that all the time. And I tell my students, just like their drafts, sometimes those aren't very good drafts. And we almost have to think of the way a lot of things are produced in journalism, either it's short of time or maybe short of context. In the case of obituaries, what we're looking at is something called collective memory. So we all have a collective memory of things we're supposed to do, ways we're supposed to act, things we're supposed to say. we all learn how to say, you know, God bless you or bless you if someone sneezes. So these are things that they're rituals or memory. When we write obituaries, we tend to write them in the era of which they're being written and not so much the past. But with these civil rights obituaries, they just seem to completely ignore our more nuanced way of looking at civil rights. Like, we all know now how strategic a lot of the decisions that were made by civil rights leaders. They chose particular Southern towns knowing that there would be violence, likely violence, and it would be captured by the media. But you don't see any of that kind of strategy involved in these obituaries. You see people who are beaten, people who suffer. So that's kind of what's emphasized.
And is it emphasized because a lot of the obituary writers are going back and only using the newspaper clips of the time, which of course were quite myopic maybe in the way they were covering these issues?
That's a great question. You know, I guess I should have asked some of the obituary writers that. I mainly just looked at the content. I'm guessing they did look at a lot of clips, and that's the reason why they come across this way. But there's also a very romantic notion of what the civil rights movement is and was. You know, to this day, I've looked at obituaries since then, and they still, you know, are kind of, oh, this person knew Martin Luther King. That's one of the things, you know, how close were you to Martin Luther King, and were you beaten up? And, you know, I think it is about the clips. I think you're right on that.
Not to suggest that an obituary writer is lazy.
Oh, not at all.
Right, not at all. But if a writer, though, is under a time pressure deadline gun, right, then the writer has maybe a limited number of resources to draw upon in which to write the obituary. And oftentimes the morgue is the first place an obituary writer goes, and it will just naturally reflect the clips of the time.
But you know, sometimes, like in the case of Rosa Parks,
yes,
where people have plenty of time, it still has her obituary still had a particular sense about them that was romanticized, is the first word that comes to my mind. You know, you can almost hear the music is very somber and everything. You know, when I'm reading, I often end up creating my own soundtrack. And I get concerned because, especially with the ones where they had more time, is that you are creating a little bit of a myth, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. Far too much myth-making and not just real reflections, right, of somebody's life and the context in which that person lived in. I noticed in reading your paper, your analysis of the multiple obituaries of Rosa Parks, which you had just mentioned, you know, that named her decision to not give up her seat on the bus as the launch pad of the civil rights movement. and this gets to your point, right? That's some myth making there, isn't it?
Oh, in a lot of ways. I mean, look, she did not give up her seat, okay? But it sort of ignores her history with the organization. It ignores the fact that there was a pregnant teenager who could have been the reason for the boycott, but the organizations chose not to make her case go forward. You know, so again, it's that not seeing the strategy of this and making this into like simple-minded martyrs.
What do we lose when we reduce our historical memory to this narrow vision?
Oh, that is a great question. Boy, you asked really, really good ones.
Thank you.
I guess for me, and I'm sure you feel this way, when you read something that you know is more complex than it's being presented, it makes me wonder what else
Oh yeah.
is that happening to? I was in class. I was sitting in on a class, and a student brought up a case study I'd written for another class, and she kind of got it completely wrong. And I thought, oh, so when I wrote so-and-so, she sort of took that as a condemnation of everything, and it made me think, did I simplify that too much, or what could I have done differently? So that's, I guess, what I worry about is, what are the messages we're sending out, and could they be misconstrued? And the civil rights movement was more than just people who got beaten up. But when you read these obituaries, you think that's what gives people value.
That's a great point. Is there anything to be gained from this approach, the kind of approach that sort of flattens the subject and their historical contributions, and maybe is like a more marketable read?
I guess nowadays you could write something like this, could write an obituary and have all kinds of links. Look, by the way, I've got to applaud the Times for its, you know, overlooked no more, forgotten no more obituaries of folks. I mean, these are people who actually got obituaries. And I know this is a side point, but I looked at, tried to find obituaries of Black Panther leaders, and they weren't nearly enough. They've been erased. So while I can say these are maybe incomplete, at least there is an attempt to tell the story. So I guess I worry more about the people who don't get obituaries, so there's nothing there. Not just to quote unquote honor them, but to let us know what our past is.
And Kathleen, share with our audience exactly what the Times is doing now, this new effort that they're making to sort of go back and, reflect the deaths of people whose lives were not honored or mentioned at the times of their death.
Well, there were so many women who did not receive obituaries in spite of their amazing accomplishments, some firsts, this and that. And they've actually gone back. I think this started about 4 years ago, and they're taking away the invisibility, might be a good way to put it. It's like the way that when people saw Hidden Figures about the Black women who worked for NASA, it was like, what? I mean, we didn't know about this? Well, they were hiding in plain sight, right? That always existed. So the Times has, which is, they're an arbiter of what's important. And there were all these people who did not receive obituaries. And they've gone back and they've added many of them.
And are you satisfied with the choices they've made?
I'm just happy they're making them, I'm just happy it's happening. I haven't looked at them critically as much as I've looked at them like, oh yeah, she really deserved an obituary. So I'm more consumer than researcher when I've looked at some of these.
Kathleen, in your paper, you write that anecdotes and exposition in obituaries place scenes or specters of violence as just as culturally important to the movement as any legislative redress it sought.
Wow, I like that.
It's pretty good. Yeah, it jumped off the page of me when I read it. Do you feel that the very mechanics of obituary writing contribute to a reductive framing of the subject?
I guess it has to, but is that unlike any other department or any other category?
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. Like a profile, for instance, right?
Right. I mean, journalism is a series of decisions. I'm actually studying Bourdieu right now in his journalistic field. And everything is like a struggle. What goes in, what goes out. why is something here and why is something not there? So I don't particularly blame obituaries. What I do blame is that we can't get past what we think civil rights is, you know? And I guess there are other subjects that that's happening too, and I'm just not as aware. And I guess that goes to my previous point. But yes, I mean, there was legislative work. You know, one of the reasons why the civil rights movement was heavily seen on television was because of the game show scandals. Television really needed to clean up its act. And it also, and it really needed something live it could show. So I guess that's the thing, is that as journalists, do we make the public aware of the decisions we make?
Well, you know? That's it. That we could have a whole separate podcast just on that, right? I mean, my thing I say often is the journalism IQ in this country is very low or at zero among readers. And I blame us. That's our fault. Mm. We don't explain ourselves nearly well enough. And as you know, there's no public editor anymore at the New York Times. We just don't do a good job of explaining precisely what we do. There's this blurring of lines, right, between the op-ed page and the news pages.
Oh, people can't tell that stuff apart online. I mean,
they cannot. No, there's really no difference. I mean, and in our minds as journalists, there's this wall, right, between the two. And there's no wall online for most things, but particularly that. And so, yeah, that's a whole other subject area we could get into, maybe on another day.
On another day, definitely.
Airmail is the sophisticated digital weekly dispatch from Graydon Carter and Alessandra Stanley. The premise of Airmail is simple. Imagine the weekend edition of a no longer in existence international daily. Airmail features articles on subjects both foreign and domestic, ranging from politics and the environment to art and literature, style and fashion, high-end crime, and beyond, by some of the world's finest journalists. For the most part, these are stories you will not find anywhere else. Airmail's weekly issue is delivered to your inbox on Saturdays at 6 a.m., making for a delightful and informative weekend read. And Airmail has recently launched Look, a beauty and wellness monthly issue edited by Allure founder Linda Wells, offering deep thoughts on superficial matters. We've featured numerous Airmail articles in the Sunday Long Read in the past, and we've decided to partner with Airmail to offer you a free 30-day trial. You'll receive Airmail's newsletters and get access to their content for 30 days, after which you can decide if you'd like to subscribe. Go to airmail.news/signup to sign up for your free trial. Again, that's airmail.news/signup. Sign up is all one word. We're speaking with Kathleen McElroy. This is episode 2 of our 4-part series on obituaries. Kathleen, white supremacy continues to underlie decisions around what stories get told, who gets to tell them, and what assumptions both writers and readers bring to any article. You wrote in 2019 that diversifying newsrooms is not enough to change the culture of that place. How can the field acknowledge the ways identity plays a role in informing our ideas around objectivity and our decisions around storytelling?
Oh, I gave the objectivity lecture to my students on Wednesday.
Okay.
We had a really good discussion about that. So my point there is that I was a success in the newsroom, in any newsroom, because I knew what a cis, white, patriarchal management would want, right? You know, at one point, yes, I am a Black woman, and I do want to use that lens, and I do try to, you know, my authenticity is important to me. But at that time in particular, you know, I know my success was being able to imitate the things that you're talking about. Not imitate, maybe that's not the right word. Execute. So nowadays, we're teaching our students that the method was supposed to be objective, though even that's kind of false, right? The objective scientific method. But can you be completely accurate? Can you be fully dimensional? And if you see something from your perspective, can you incorporate it into the story that enriches it? So I think some schools still teach old-fashioned objectivity, and I've read the Marty Baron piece that he recently wrote.
Yeah.
I talked to Marty in a conference event, and I think I brought up objectivity, and he shot those steely eyes at me.
I've been on the receiving end of those steely eyes when Marty was a editor at the New York Times in the late 90s. Yeah,
yeah.
I know how that feels.
So it's important that students know how to gather information that approaches truth. I mean, one of the problems we have, I mean, let alone disinformation and misinformation and malinformation, all of which I have to teach my students, but the importance that random facts are just that, random, you know. So teaching them context, teaching them not both-sidism, and teaching them to not elevate illegitimate voices, right? So at one point, people thought, oh, if you just get quotes from both sides, or this quote's going to be really what I'm thinking, but I'm going to have somebody else say it. You know, I'm making them aware of all of that, which I don't know when I was in school that we kind of knew what we were doing, but nobody said it out loud. So I think part of my job now is to say it out loud. But, you know, as someone put it, these are strategic rituals that we're doing.
And how do your students take these lessons? I'm curious about, I mean, are they aware that of sort of both sides-ism and that kind of thing not really being what they should do anymore, although there's still some of that in journalism? You can find that. And obviously, readers are very critical of it, far more critical of it today than they were even 10 years ago, right?
Yes.
Or 5 years ago.
Well, you know, one of the tough things is that I do tell them about, even though I'm talking about objectivity in this way, if you go out on that first internship, don't go say, well, Professor McElroy said objectivity is a bad thing. It's like, no, don't do that. So it's kind of like sort of saying, so this is why people thought this was a good idea. And it's the idea behind it was good, but in many ways it was used as a weapon, especially against people of color and people from marginalized groups, journalists of color and journalists from marginalized groups. And I tell them from Pam Newkirk's book that there were blacks not allowed, the Daily News didn't allow blacks to cover the O.J. Simpson trial is what I think she wrote. There were places that wouldn't send, you know, African-Americans to Africa because, well, they couldn't be objective. Sort of like, okay, that doesn't mean you don't send whites to cover Timothy McVeigh or Dylann Roof, you know? So how that you're trying to figure out a way to make your reporting as close to the ideal of truth with a capital T.
Yeah, and for a long time, obviously, well, actually, probably from the very beginning when the printing press was invented, fairness, that kind of idealized view of fairness, of allowing both sides to have a voice in a story, that trumped everything,
mm-hmm.
right? That was more important when I went to journalism school in the mid-'80s. You got to be fair when you write your stories. That's what we were taught.
Which is interesting because fear is actually not what you want to be in journalism.
That's right. That's right. No, that's right. But that fairness idea, it's actually not an idea. It's an ideal, right? That you are coming at something with a blank slate and you don't have any biases or any background that you're bringing to this job as a journalist. And so what you're going to try to do for the reader is just be fair as opposed to tell them the truth. And those are two diametrically opposed missions.
Right. So, and it's tough because they always ask, students will ask, well, how many people do I need to talk to? How many people? And the answer is, it depends, right?
Yeah.
But trying, this is another thing on top of being a journalism major in this decade that, you know, let's just put everything else on top. Oh, and by the way, now we want you to really use your critical thinking, you know, strengths. So they have to think about a lot of stuff like that. So go ahead.
No, I was going to say, look, it's challenging, obviously, for journalism students. It's also challenging for editors and publishers, right? I mean, this question of objectivity and truth. And I guess as an educator and somebody who was in a newsroom for such a long time, how do you think newsrooms can hold themselves better accountable for seeking truth and not falling into some of these objectivity, and I'm using air quotes, traps?
Okay. And by the way, again, I want to point out that the idea of trying to have the most robust truth, and I think I might use that expression in class.
It's good.
Is a good one, right? So,
yeah.
And what's interesting is that newsrooms don't really have a lot of time to think about this stuff, especially these days, I'm guessing, you know?
24-hour news cycle. There's not, you know, years ago, just one newspaper came out every 24 hours. There was a lot more time to sit around and contemplate stories than there's been, you know, since the internet, the rise of the internet and the digital age, for sure.
Yeah, so that's why I think it's important that we try to expose them to as many of these concepts, but not too many, but I guess what I mean is that maybe one day when they're in a situation, they'll remember, oh, we're not just supposed to talk to that person just because they're there.
We'd like to tell you about a recent article in Airmail that caught our eye. Ezra Chowake.
Students how to do advanced Google searches. Get past the first page. Let's just take a look at it.
You're looking at the New York Times?
I'm looking at the Times. Okay. I'm looking at it. And look, a son of sharecroppers.
Yep.
And an apostle of nonviolence.
Right at the top. Yep.
Oh. Yeah.
So that's not an obituary that treated John Lewis's life with more nuance, with what you were hoping to see when you wrote your paper a decade ago.
But here's another element that's makes this equation a little hard. These leaders would give the same quotes to everybody. They knew what got published. And what got published was being beaten up and that type of stuff. Talking about strategy was ignored.
You know, Kathleen, we're living in a uniquely fraught political and social landscape. I'm curious how you think journalists should think more critically about what they cover and how their contributions will form the basis for future analysis of this era in American history.
Well, first of all, I hope that there is still a world where journalism is valued and absorbed. There are too many people who don't know where to get information, where to get valid information. I do think the journalism that is left is going to be what you're talking about. It is going to be more nuanced, it's going to be more sophisticated. It will come closer to a quote unquote truth, right? And I think newsrooms are getting the message. It's just right now, depending on the medium you're in, is there time? I mean, I think one reason why podcasts are popular is because by their very nature, they make you take time. And you can have a nuanced conversation. You can bring up additional points that maybe other spaces, can't.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. They dig deeper. There's more context. Oftentimes, you'll hear a writer describe a story in the telling of a story, in the reporting of a story, and it's far more compelling than the story itself. So, yeah, that's a good point about podcasts for sure. Have you noticed any improvement in, particularly in the way African Americans, obits, are written? Just in the
Well,
last year or two versus, when you were doing your research, or even 4 or 5 years before that.
I think there are more kinds of people getting obituaries, which is good, but I mean,
The cliches are hard to kill off, aren't they?
they in an obituary. I like that.
Yeah, they
That was
are.
clever. But I think it is. I think it's just very hard. And look, if I were writing obituaries on a regular basis, I'm not saying they would be any better, by the way. I want to go on the record on that. This is very, very hard to do. And that's why someone like Marguerite is just so talented, because she does, in a short amount of time, sort of create that 360. And we use that term a lot. I use that term a lot with my students. Like, are you creating a 360 of the person? There are obituaries I've read that were, I think, more clever than informative.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, Kathleen. I can't thank you enough for joining us. It was a total pleasure to speak with you, and I hope we can continue the conversation. Let's do it again.
So too. I really, really enjoyed this, and thank you for your really smart questions.
Thank you, Kathleen. Next week on the podcast, we'll talk to an obituary writer who has published a how-to guide to writing your own obituary. The Art of Remembering is a series from the Sunday Long Read podcast, an audio extension of the Sunday Long Read. Since 2014, the SLR has curated the very best journalism every week and drops in your inbox every Sunday morning. For more information, www.sundaylongread.com. Subscribe to the Sunday Long Read podcast on Spotify or Apple to make sure you don't miss a single episode. Thanks to our sponsor, Airmail. Your essential weekend read from Graydon Carter, former editor of Vanity Fair, and Alessandra Stanley of the New York Times. This episode was produced by Veronica Dixon Larada, Etienne Lajoie, Alex Fuse, and Jacob Feldman. My name is Don Van Natta. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us next week.